Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. And I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints says a 60 Minutes episode about its investment portfolio is based on unfounded allegations. LGBTQ plus students in Utah County walk out to protest the school board's silence on removing pride flags. And Kennecott's tailings may creep even closer to homes in Magna. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Simmerad. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. We have reporter Courtney Tanner with us. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday. Report for America Corps member Alexel Cabrera is with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And news columnist Robert Gerke will be providing commentary throughout the hour. Thanks, Robert.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Tom.
Good morning. Well, let's start with you, Tony Simmerad, real estate reporter. So that headline, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has responded to a 60 Minutes episode about its investment portfolio. It's disputing some of the claims made on the program. So Tony Simmerad, this was an interview, I think, on 60 Minutes with David Nielsen. Tell us who David Nielsen is.
Yes, so this was the CBS News Magazine's interview with a former portfolio manager for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who has since, as of late 2019, turned into an IRS whistleblower about the sort of financial activities of the manager of the church's portfolio, a company called Ensign Peak Advisors. David L. A. Nielsen had not spoken publicly about these allegations he made, as I said, in late 2019, that not only have to do with the potentially vast scope of these investments. His estimate is that the fund had surpassed $100 billion at some point, but also his claims that it has acted more kind of as a clandestine hedge fund rather than a charitable kind of fund, in that it has not spent, according to Mr. Nielsen's allegations, on charitable activities, even though it's built around the tithing funds of members.
Remind us what happened. I think this was a ruling from, was it the SEC? This was a few months ago. We had John at that point. What the church agreed to, there was a fine, I believe.
Yeah, that is related to this. In February, the Securities and Exchange Commission fined Ensign Peak Advisors and the church a total of $5 million for an alleged scheme in which Ensign and Peak Advisors had created a bunch of shell companies to kind of, in effect, shield the church's ownership of about $32 billion in investments. This pattern was of obfuscation, if you will, was kind of highlighted by David A. Nielsen's claims initially in 2019, and then those were investigated starting in 2020 by the Securities Exchange Commission, and they settled that in February. And it's related, if only in the sense that it also kind of highlights what Nielsen has been talking about the secrecy with which the church approaches this fund. It has gone to great lengths to kind of obscure the size of the fund.
Now, David Nielsen, his idea of what that fund is for and what the church is saying, they believe the fund is for two very different views. Tell me first what David Nielsen's view of what that fund should be doing.
Well, you know, there was a very compelling aspect to his 60 Minutes interview in that we sort of got a personal glimpse of his arc in all of this. He kind of described himself as an enthusiastic and idealistic kind of candidate when he first started working for Ensign Peak. He envisioned using these funds to do great works in the world. And according to him, over the course of his tenure there from 2010 to 2019, he found that, according to his claim, is that the these fund managers were really just in the business of building the fund through investments rather than any sort of philanthropic spending. I think his quote was, once the money went in, it didn't go out, and there was this sense that it wasn't a great sort of charitable activity. Instead, it was sort of more like I said, kind of operated as a clandestine hedge fund, in that it's tax exempt, and yet was in the same business as other hedge funds of sort of building capital.
I think the quote stood out to me from from his interview, according to your reporting. He said, I'd joined up thinking that we were going to change the world. In other words, he thought this would be a bunch of charitable spending, when instead it's just kind of building up.
Yeah. Yeah. The fallout over the course of the week has been very interesting. Shortly after, it aired, I believe it was Monday, the church issued a statement, essentially saying that it considered it unfortunate that 60 Minutes sought to kind of elevate this story. And they're characterizing Nielsen as just somebody, a former employee who has sort of a different view of how they should spend their money rather than raising any sort of legal or tax implications. They called them unfounded allegations. At least the allegation having to do with the SEC violations is clearly not unfounded. The SEC found there was a violation there, but that's how they characterize it. And as you can imagine, in the sort of Latter-day Saint blogosphere, this has been a very active topic of discussion during the ensuing week. The church's respondent, if you will, in the 60 Minutes interview, Bishop Christopher Waddell from the presiding bishopric, was generally seen to have not done so well during the interview, did not seem as prepared for certain key questions, while Nielsen was sort of sympathetic. But, the views on social media are really kind of scattered on this as to whether or not the church, sort of faces any sort of major questions here.
What did specifically, what did Bishop Waddell say? What is his view of what this fund is for?
Well, he characterized it more as a kind of an auxiliary to the church with regard to its tax exempt status, kind of the faith's treasury, if you will, and goes for vital things like operations and that the money. That Nielsen, according to Bishop Waddell, does not have the full picture, and indeed the fund is used for church and charitable activities, and it seemed kind of more as a rainy day fund to buffer the church economically. But he was steadfast in this notion of not revealing details about the fund. At one point, he was sort of pressed by the 60 Minutes correspondent, does $150 billion sound like it was in the ballpark? And he would only smile, and at one point said that the church had significant resources, but kind of characterizing this not so much as secrecy, but rather than a sort of a confidential approach to the account. He was quite steadfast in not revealing any additional details about the fund.
So as I say, that's a very different view that Bishop Waddell, I guess the church is saying this is the treasury. This is some of it's being used, but otherwise it's a rainy day fund. Different view from Mr. Nielsen. I guess in the 60 Minutes interview, David Nielsen didn't talk about his previous call for Congress to investigate the church's finances.
Yeah, that was notably omitted. He submitted a very much more sort of fleshed out version of his complaint with the U.S. Senate's Finance Committee in late January, detailing, adding a lot more kind of detail to his complaints. And it's been notable that none of the presiding members on that Senate Finance Committee have made any kind of reference to that letter as to what's supposed to happen from here. The 60 Minutes interview included a former IRS official who had kind of looked at this, and he was of the opinion that any sort of major investigation by a government agency was probably politically unlikely, just that there would be a tremendous political reaction to that, to a sort of probe into a church like that. But nonetheless, said that, you know, some of the issues at stake probably deserved further investigation.
Again, Bishop Waddell, he says, I'll just quote him here, "We don't feel it's being secret, we feel it's being confidential." So again, you know, that's their view, the church's view, I suppose.
Yeah, that's correct, and that has been a in a number of sort of public venues, that has been the consistent stance of the church that, you know, given that this is built on tithing, which the church sort of considers sacred, it's part of this broader sort of confidential approach to its finances.
Found this interesting. Mr. Nielsen, somewhere in the here, he says that he thinks the church's view is you build up this big fund, and it in his view, it's not going to be used until the second coming of Jesus Christ. Bishop Waddell pushed back on that, I believe.
Nielsen seemed to sort of characterize that as the presiding or the providing or prevailing, I should say, comment among Ensign Peak advisor employees that it was for the second coming. Waddell said, even though, you know, church members do believe in that, that this was a sort of a more earthly and practical protection against economic downturns or anything like that, that it had a more kind of operational and practical use for the fund.
So, Tony Semmerad, you had a separate story, I guess, looking at where that investment fund stands right now. The church's or an Ensign Peak is not required to divulge all of its assets, right? But they are required to divulge some. So, which is which?
Yeah, so these are publicly traded assets, you know, stocks and bonds and mutual funds that are in this account. And as of late 2019, Ensign Peak Advisors has been filing a quarterly report on that portion of what it holds, which is the portion that it is required, having investments in equities and that sort of thing above 100 million. It does meet the criteria for reporting those. And so it's been a kind of an interesting quarterly track on where that fund is invested, you know, interesting mix of stocks and bonds, as they say, and mutual funds, and also its performance, which, you know, it's a generally kind of invested fund akin to the Standard and Poor's 500, you know, in terms of market performance. But these are big numbers. You know, I think the last story had it at about 43 billion and in change, and it's been as high as 52 billion. But yes, again, this is a partial glimpse of what Ensign Peak Advisors is managing as required by law.
It's interesting. What tell us some of the companies that this fund's invested in.
Well, you know, it's invested in the way any sort of smart, broad portfolio investor might invest in the market. A lot of technology stocks, big $2 billion chunks of Apple and Microsoft, and then, you know, primarily. In terms of the larger investments, they're all, you know, standard sort of blue chip stocks like JP Morgan and United Health and Johnson and Johnson, and like I say, the kind of stocks that institutional investors invest in.
So what do we think is next? I guess there's no announcement of any other investigations, right? But I guess something in Congress could happen, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that there's an interesting question is with regard to timing on this. Why David A. Nielsen it came forward when he did on Sunday, and in the interview he seemed to kind of characterize investigations by the IRS and the Department of Justice as having been, you know, he'd given them ample time, professional courtesy for them to do whatever they were going to or not going to do. And so he felt like he was sort of coming forward to add, you know, bring some additional public attention, given that those investigations aren't going anywhere. That's every indication from our reporting is there's that nobody is none of these government agencies are offering evidence of a continuing ongoing investigation as of the $5 million SEC fine. The church has said it considers this matter closed. And so I think that is a sort of an open-ended aspect of this, is where does it go next? And it's not clear.
Well, Tony Semrad is Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter. Thanks, Tony.
You bet.
I hope you'll stay around for the Underplayed Story of the Week a little later on. Robert Gerke, what do you think about all of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that we kind of need to take a step back, I think, and consider, you know, why we have these tax exemptions for religious institutions. And I think the theory behind them is that they're going to do good in the community or further the faith and you know, of the members. And it's hard to see how this fits that criteria in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, maybe having some rainy day fund, so to speak, is wise. But having a rainy day fund that would, you know, help you weather Noah's flood is a little bit excessive. So I think it raises some valuable questions. And I think Congress should at least consider the criteria that's applied to these sorts of reserve funds. I mean, it's there's no end to it the way it's being interpreted now. They could have trillions of dollars in there and still not be paying taxes on it. So, you know, I think it warrants some scrutiny from somewhere in the, you know, in the government, in Congress or the IRS. And you know, I get that the church is sensitive about it, but I don't know that telling them that they shouldn't be stockpiling billions of dollars is necessarily impeding their ability to exercise their religion. So, you know, I think it raises some important issues that need a little bit more exploration. I will also say, you know, most, if not all of what was in the 60 Minutes report was already known to us, I think, because of the reporting of Tony and Peggy and others at the Tribune and other outlets.
You can find all of that at sltrib.com. Well, let's head toward a break here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. When we come back, we're going to be talking about LGBTQ plus students in Utah County walking out to protest the school board's silence on removing pride flags at a high school. We'll be talking with Courtney Tanner following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. Let's turn to this story. The headline is LGBTQ plus students in Utah County walk out to protest the school board's silence on removing pride flags. We turn to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So this is Utah County, I believe, Sky Ridge High School. Where is Sky Ridge?
Sky Ridge High School is in Lehi.
Okay. And so there were how many students walked out?
I estimated more than 100, maybe 150 total.
Yeah. What are they protesting?
Right. It's kind of a saga, but essentially the school district ordered that their school administrators at Sky Ridge take down all the pride flags within the school, like any in the classrooms or the hallways. Just every pride flag was removed.
So does Utah have a law on this, or do they let the districts kind of just regulate this?
Yeah, districts usually decide. So Utah law states essentially that teachers should never like physically talk about their political beliefs or their religious beliefs. And then each district kind of interprets that differently. In Alpine School District, they have a policy that says you can't have any displays of anything that's personal or political in the classroom that like kind of represents your beliefs as a teacher. And so they interpret the policy to say, okay, that includes LGBTQ plus pride flags. Davis School District, pretty similar. They don't allow pretty much any flag but the American flag. But Salt Lake City School District does allow pride flags and actually encourages schools to have pride flags up. So it definitely depends on the district.
Did Alpine have a policy before this?
They did. Yeah, they hadn't enforced it, I guess, is maybe the best way to put it.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
Yeah, and it's kind of vague, and the students will argue that too. That essentially, you know, it says you can't have a personal or political display, but what does that mean? Does that include pride flags? The district says it does. The students say, look, pride flag isn't political, it's just who I am.
Yeah. So as I understand it from your reporting, this issue, I'm just quoting from the story, the issue came to the forefront after a photo of a student with a flag visible in the background, pride flag, I assume, was posted on the school's Instagram page. What happened there?
Right. Yeah. So the school's Instagram page in March had taken this photo of the student that was winning an award. They posted it, you know, not really necessarily thinking about what was behind them. And there were some pride flags behind them. And so some conservative parents kind of stormed the comment section of the Instagram post, saying that they think these flags are used for grooming. And so the school district, you know, took down the post, or the school took down the post, and then the school district told the school to take down the flags.
There was a student who launched an online petition, I believe.
Right. Yes. Olivia Brown. She's a junior at Skyridge. She reacted to the flags being taken down by starting this petition. It now has more than 3,000 signatures. The students also did like a mini Pride Day after the flags were taken down, where they all kind of wore, you know, rainbow colors to school, and kind of exhibited, you know, what they wanted with the pride flags in their own wardrobe.
What's the school board saying about this?
The school board has been silent, and that is what is frustrating to these students. So they held that little Pride Day, and then they also went to a school board meeting to talk about what the flags meant to them and to say, you know, we want these flags back up in our school. And the school board didn't say anything at that time because it wasn't on their agenda. So according to Utah law, they can't actually bring it up, but they haven't put it on any agenda since then. And it's been more than a month since these students went to that school board meeting, and they're frustrated that they haven't gotten any kind of response from the district.
What are these students saying about what the flags mean to them? What have they lost, do they think, having the pride flags removed?
So many of them, you know, see these pride flags as a symbol of safety, you know, that they know which classrooms or which teachers are accepting and who they can go talk to. You know, it also is kind of this acknowledgement, this acceptance of who they are. So, you know, these students are really invested in these flags and really found some comfort in them being up in their school.
There was a small counter protest, I understand.
There was, and there was one beforehand too, when the students held their kind of mini Pride Day in March at the school. There was, you know, kind of a larger group at that point that kind of taunted them, ran around with large American flags, called them slurs. And so that was during the school day. And then they also held this protest this week, obviously. And there were about 5 students that came out and kind of stood on the opposite sidewalk and waved American flags and Donald Trump flags and opposed pride flags being in schools.
By the way, are there other flags allowed, you know, that might be seen as a kind of an opposite, don't tread on me flags or that kind of thing?
Yeah, and the students who want the pride flags point that out. You know, there are the Gadsden flags or the Don't Tread on Me flags. There are BYU flags in the school, which, you know, has frustrated some of these students, saying, you know, like, that's a religious symbol because BYU is run by the church. There are portraits of George Washington praying in the school. So there's all these kind of other symbols that these students are saying, well, you know, why aren't you interpreting those as against the policy when you are saying that the pride flag is?
Understand, there were a couple of other high schools that had some walkouts.
Yeah, 2 other high schools joined these students, Lehigh and Westlake, which are also in Utah County and Alpine School District. They also held little solidarity walkouts for these kids.
I also understand that when the pride flags were taken down, some of the LGBTQ plus students are saying that classmates felt emboldened then to harass them. I guess that's their interpretation of the timing.
Yeah, so they have talked to us at the Tribune about this and shared videos of this too, but there are students that were like burning the pride flag. There were students that were like tearing them up, throwing them in the garbage. students calling them slurs, which also happened at the protest on Monday. You know, there were cars driving by in Utah County, which we all know is conservative, but cars driving by with adults yelling slurs at these students.
I was interested in this. You report some students say they don't have support at home regarding their identity, sexual identity, and so school is the essentially their safe place.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear that. And, you know, these students said, look, when we go home, we can't really be who we are, because they maybe don't have family members or parents that support the LGBTQ community or are maybe more conservative. So these students say, you know, look, we've found a place at school where we spend the majority of our day to, you know, find a community of people who are like us, to, you know, be able to be open about how we identify.
So what are these students wanting there? I guess obviously put the pride flags back, right? But I guess at minimum for the board to say something, what do they want?
Yeah, I think that's well put. So, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately they'd love for the pride flags to be back, but they are really just pushing for some kind of response by the district, for the district to acknowledge, you know, what they've been saying, what they're going through, how they're feeling. And so far it has just been quiet.
We just have maybe a minute or two in this segment. I'll have you just give me your minute recap of another story you did. There's an ex-BYU professor took a plea deal in a case involving sexual battery of three female students. Tell me just very briefly about this.
Yeah. So Michael James Clay was a professor at BYU over urban and regional planning, which is in the geography department. A student had come forward in 2020 accusing him of touching her inappropriately, of offering her counseling, which he was not qualified to do, and using his position or misrepresenting his position in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which owns BYU, essentially saying that he had authority in the church and that she needed to listen to him, that he could give her blessings. And so she came forward and reported that to police. He was charged with felonies at that point. For sexually abusing her. And then two more students came forward with really similar stories, essentially about how he had used his position within the church and within the school and as their boss to, you know, exert control over their futures and to, you know, touch them inappropriately or to do what he wanted and then tell them to be quiet about it. And so again, charged with more felonies at that point. And then he agreed to a plea deal last week, which happened just before he was supposed to go on trial, and he pleaded no contest to three misdemeanors.
All right. Reporter Courtney Tanner has been with us to tell us about a couple of stories here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And we'll look for your underplayed story of the week a little later in the hour. Robert Gerke, what do you think about the pride flags in the Alpine School District?
Well, like Courtney touched on, I think at a bare minimum, these kids are entitled to a response. I mean, the district owes them that much. I mean, to ignore them, I think, is an insult. You know, and you know, it is one of these things where schools do need policies on what is displayed and what, you know, in classrooms. You don't want things that are disruptive. I think that these probably weren't nearly as disruptive before as they are now that they've been ordered to be taken down, because now they've become the focal point of all this attention. Courtney, if you're still on, I mean, I had a question about the kids that were taunting and burning the pride flag and calling names. I mean, that seems like that's a clear violation of school policy as well. Do you know if there's been any action taken to respond to that?
We have been told that no action has been taken. The principal actually sent out an email to parents kind of ignoring the problem there, which is obviously the slurs and the taunting and the burning of flags, but saying that those students also had a right to make their opinions known, which, yeah, kind of doesn't get at the problem.
That doesn't sit well with me, because I mean, there's a clear school policy against that as well. And so they need to be even handed in their enforcement. But, you know, sort of taking a step back, I think there is a reason for optimism here. I mean, this generation of kids, I'm old enough to remember when East High went through the Gay Straight Alliance kerfuffle back in the 90s. And, you know, that was the big lightning rod issue. I think this generation of kids is so much more dialed in and so much more attuned to the need to be inclusive, and you know, notwithstanding that small group that of you know, knuckle draggers, I think that, you know, there's reason for hope here, and whether or not the school board comes around on this, I think it's what the LGBTQ kids in Utah County have hopefully seen out of this is that they do have friends and supporters who are willing to go to bat for them and have their back. So maybe that's the Pollyanna spin on it, but that's maybe that's the silver lining to this whole unfortunate episode.
Well, you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. When we come back, we'll be talking with Report for America Corps member Alexa Cabrera, and we'll be talking about some plans that Kennecott has, tailings, which may creep even closer to homes in Magna. We'll have more following this break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to Report for America Corps member Alexa Cabrera. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about your story about Kennecott, Rio Tinto Kennecott, I guess. They're owned by Rio Tinto. And we want to talk about tailing ponds, which they're wanting some, I guess, extra area for tailing ponds. Might get uncomfortably close to Magna. Tell us, first of all, just remind us, a tailing pond, what goes in there?
Yes. So in Magna, there are about 9,000 acres of tailing ponds. And tailings are whatever is discharged after the mining operation. So after they extract copper, everything that is around it, that is like maybe some sort of soil, it goes to those ponds. So it's sort of like the discharges of the mining operations.
And then that's, I guess that's going to sit there for a long time, I suppose, the tailings.
Yes. Yes. So right now there are two, they call them impoundments, but one of them is completely dry, and that is the south impoundment that hasn't received active tailings since 2001, but they have been there for a long time. Yeah.
Let's see. So this is part of a plan. They want to extend operations out until about 2040, right?
Yes. Now Kennecott is planning on expanding their tailings impoundments to the southeastern portion of it. So, you know, that site that I mentioned that was completely dry may be seeing tailings again. This is to accommodate the extension of the Bingham Canyon mine until 2040 and to provide seismic stability too.
So how close is this to Magna? How close is this to homes?
Yes. So the closest resident is about 1,000 feet away and separated by State Road 201. And I mean, yeah, it is pretty close because it's the southern part of the impoundments. The northern part you cannot see from the road, and you actually have to take one of the cars from Kennecott to get to that.
Mm-hmm. Now the mayor is kind of torn. I imagine a lot of people in town are as well. On the one hand, it provides jobs. On the other hand, this could be an environmental problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough, it's a complex issue for Magna. So in one hand, there's a lot of dust in the site. Whenever there's high wind days, you basically cannot see where you're going. Like, I went on a nice day, so I didn't really experience the dust, but a lot of my sources tell me that the vision is very, it's blocked by the dust. However, Magna, a lot of people in Magna work for Kennecott, and Kennecott really does a lot for the town. They have a lot of programs, and actually the mayor used to work for Kennecott. So it is a really, like, it's a mining town, and it's, for them, it's not like black and white. It's very complex, and jobs are, like, they really play a very important factor in this issue.
What are Kennecott officials saying? Are they saying that this is going to be fine?
Yes. This project has a lot of elements to it. So the ultimate result that they want to do is that they want to improve their tailings storage, but they also want to build a wall. So, like, this whole impoundment is, like, more stable. And if there were to be another earthquake in Magna, the tailings wouldn't spill.
Yeah. And one official you talked to said, hey, we're very regulated, and we're well within regulations with all of these things.
Yeah. And they say that these tailings are better quality than other tailings, and they contain metals, but their levels could be replicable in backyards, and they're only high in copper. However, some environmental advocates say that no matter what the chemical composition of the dust has, it's really bad for people to be breathing PM2.5 and PM10. And that's, like, it's very possible for people in Magna to be breathing these things because they're so close to these tailing impoundments.
I see. Yeah. So, so that even if, you don't have high, toxic content in the dust, just the fact that, you have these particles, PM2.5 is not good. So you talked to Molly Blakowski. Is that how you pronounce it? Doctoral candidate at Utah State University.
Yeah.
What is she saying?
Well, she was one that to describe to me how's the scene in a very windy day. So she was going to salt air, and windy days, there's a very dusty scene. So you can, like, it's very hard to breathe. It's very hard to see whatever you're driving. And she's very concerned about the PM2.5 and PM10 emissions from the ponds. And, it's just, she explained to me that whatever the composition it is, this is enriched in zinc or copper and other heavy metals that people shouldn't be breathing. So, yeah, like, only the thought that these tailings can be even larger and even closer to communities is very concerning to her.
Hmm. I guess some folks are worried that some of this waste could reach the Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake.
Yeah, and one of the things about the tailings is that they discharge water to the Great Salt Lake that can sometimes have selenium. So Friends of Great Salt Lake are concerned about that. However, what Kennecott officials say is that the water is a very good quality water, and that during high winds, they have suspended soils, which is a challenge, but then they stop the discharge.
Linda Freitas is quoted in your story, Executive Director of Friends of Great Salt Lake. She was saying, well, Kennecott basically owns Zocher Mountains. There's a lot of area there. Why can't they put some of these tailings elsewhere? What does Kennecott say?
Right. And that is one of the issues with this. They want the location of this expansion to be elsewhere, and they think that it should be in the Ocker Mountains, so people don't have, like, are not really that close to it. However, what Kennecott says is that this is already an industrial area, and it's right next to the current impoundment. So, like, it wouldn't change. It makes sense to them. However, this is not necessarily the location. Like, this is the preferred location of Kennecott. However, they are going through a environmental impact study, and whatever, like, this option is not necessarily what we'll see in the future.
And that impact study is being, that'll be the Army Corps of Engineers, right?
Yes, the U.S. Corps of Engineers is doing that study, because it would affect 44 acres of U.S. waters.
There's somebody from the Corps said that only one person attended one of the scoping meetings. Described that as disappointing, which I guess it is. What's next for that study?
So right now they're reviewing all of the comments that they got. So they only received one attendant to each of the meetings that they had, which were two. But they did receive comments online. So they're reviewing them to explore which options are best and some alternatives that they may not have considered. So they're working on that.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. I'm sure you'll be reporting on this. Alex Cabrera with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll get your underplayed story of the week just in a few minutes here. Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Yeah, this is a tough one, I think, because certainly if you're a resident of Magna, you're not crazy about the idea of these tailings being even closer to you. And it seems like, you know, it makes sense, I guess, that Kennecott could look somewhere else for a new tailings pile, but it's not quite that simple, because you need transportation and so forth and dust control and all of these things. So, and all, obviously all of that's already here. So I get the tension and, you know, I'm good to see the residents speaking out against it. You know, it's always hard to take on an institution like Kennecott that's so, you know, established and powerful in the valley. So, I would be concerned if I was them, and I would be trying to, you know, push for other alternatives or other options, or at least some enhanced mitigation measures that might be available.
Well, we have three-ish minutes before our underplayed stories of the week, and have with me right now news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, I counted out on at least four stories this week. So let's crunch through a couple of these anyway. The one I want to start with, you've been talking about this. It's the homes in Draper that have been collapsing as the mountain has collapsed, and the inability of a city like Draper to regulate, hands tied by the legislature. Governor Cox has recently weighed in on this. What's he saying?
Yeah. So on Wednesday, during legislative meetings, the state geologist actually reiterated that he thinks as well that municipalities need to have a little bit more leverage when they're dealing with developers, because, you know, as we've talked about on the program, the mayor of Draper felt like their hands were tied when it comes to approving developments. Basically, if a developer comes to him with a proposal, they have few options other than to approve it. And so the balance, it's out of balance, according to the state geologist. And yesterday the governor was asked about that, and he said he has had some talks with the mayor. He's open to the discussion of trying to rebalance the roles that the developer and the city have, just, you know, to ensure that the cities have are doing what they can do, at least to make sure that the construction projects they approve are safe. He said he doesn't want cities to be just telling every developer, no, you can't build, because we need the housing and we need to bring, you know, housing prices down. But on the other hand, you know, you want to make sure that it's done safely and that we don't have incidents like we saw in Draper. And this is not just a Draper issue. I mean, the state geologist said they're monitoring over 100 landslides this year because of all the groundwater and saturation that from the heavy snowpack. And they're up and down the state, up and down the mountain ranges along the state. And so it's not just a Draper issue. This is an issue that affects communities all across the state.
Yeah, there's, you know, geologists have their eye on this. This is not unknown information, right? Some of these areas. But I guess right now the city can't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unknown. There need to, the geologist says they need more money for mapping, and so forth. But it's also an issue, he said, where people, because of the density and the urbanization of the state, people are building in places where maybe 40 years ago they wouldn't have tried to build. And sometimes those places can be, prone to landslides and other geologic hazards.
So let's just do 30 seconds or a minute on this story. Cyber attacks. There's recently been an audit, right, probing for vulnerability of, I guess, state agencies to cyber attacks. Tell us very briefly about this.
Yeah. Governments always struggle with this because they just don't have the, they don't really put the resources into protecting information the way that maybe the private sector does or many private sector companies do. But this audit said that a lot of state agencies, and not just state agencies, but also, county, local government, school districts, so forth, don't have measures in place to protect the information that they have to prevent cyber attacks. And the most, I think the most direct quote from this audit was that, cyber attacks have cost the state millions in the past and will continue to cost the state millions unless these steps are taken. And if we step back and think about it, about all the information these governments have, private information, our information, it's really essential that they do take all of the necessary measures to try to protect that and prevent it from being breached. The state is doing some things, it's taken some steps in the last couple of years to sort of beef up its cybersecurity profile. And so, but it's always one of those things where the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that there most of the places that they surveyed don't have a response plan. And the response plan is critical because, you do everything you can to prevent it, but once you are breached, you have to have a ability to respond and try to limit the damage. And so all of these things are steps that the auditor said need to be taken. And the governor agreed, and they're hoping that they're working on some of these measures to try to get them in place.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. I'll start with Tony Semmerad. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, I am going to highlight the passing of Dick Norris, a longtime KSL anchor for 43 years, passed away this last week. There's some wonderful tributes on our site and others, sltrib.com.
SLTrib.com. Yeah, a lot of us grew up with Dick Norris. Turn to Courtney Tanner next. What's your underplayed story of the week?
I know she's on the show, but just anything by Alex L. And I want to make sure that we get her name right too, because she is a force to be reckoned with. But anything that Alex L. writes is just amazing. Additionally, there's a great story by Alex Behar about Grantsville students who are both dancers and wrestlers, and it was just a fascinating read.
Well, thank you. So that's on sltrib.com as well. So, Alex L., what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, Courtney, you're too kind. My underplayed story is by Peyton Harkins. Intermountain Health will not provide bottom surgery for trans patients despite hiring a surgical director with that expertise. And it just explores the question whether this was a business decision or if it was discriminatory.
All right. SLTrib.com for that story. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, the January 6th riot was a long time ago now, it seems like, but just this week, the 13th Utahn was charged in participating in the Capitol riots. Guy's name is Odin Meekum. And he swung a pole and hit some officers with a wooden pole, threw a metal pole at some, was, just. And this guy, it's not in our story, but he's actually a former MMA fighter. But this is the, like I said, the 13th Utahn charged in it. So that there's still, fallout from those riots. And you can check out the whole story at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com. My underplayed story of the week is from Tim Fitzpatrick. Rocky Mountain Power is going to roll out 20 fast charging stations for Utah EVs. And I guess the idea here is they're not all going to be on the side of the road out somewhere. They're thinking maybe people like to recharge downtown in some of our wonderful smaller towns. So that will be coming. We have room for another underplayed story of the week if somebody has an extra one. Robert, let's go, and the minute we have left, let's have you give your 30-second version of this story on Attorney General Sean Reyes.
So what happened was that the state had purchased all of these, their child ID kits and their card where you can put down your child's information on it. The problem is we spent about $1.8 million on these, but there are private there are nonprofit organizations and government organizations that give these out for free. The guy who runs the company that distributes these happens to be close with Sean, has a relationship with him, and it brought him out to Lambeau Field and gave him the Man of the Year award. And it's just one of these things where it kind of doesn't pass the smell test when we're spending all of this money on going to companies that have personal ties with the Attorney General. And there's also, you know, the reporting by ProPublica and the Texas Tribune just question whether these actually work. And the last part of it is there's no plan to distribute these. School districts I talked to said they haven't seen any of them. So we've got 700,000 of these ID kits that are basically useless.
Yeah. Well, I read the whole thing at sltrib.com. We've been talking with real estate reporter Tony Semerad, reporter Courtney Tanner, Report for America Corps member Alex L. Cabrera, and news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from KCPW, the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll join me next week.